This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasothi. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, in the studio with me.
Drenched.
Yes. You know, it's chucking down
it
outside,
is
George.
Atrocious.
Yes,
rain.
It is.
A torrential yeah. rain.
And you've run up, obviously, yes. because you were late.
As usual.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
But, you know, it's like this is a very important program, so I have to be here.
It is, absolutely. And, you know, we have a very important person in the studio with us and, you know, very interesting development in the country as far as cancer drugs are concerned. Earlier this week, the Health Ministry announced that it has approved the biosimilar version of a cancer drug, which is a targeted therapy for women mm-hmm. with the HER2-positive breast cancer. And the biosimilar version will significantly reduce the cost of treatment, which currently costs about 130,000 ringgit a year.
Yes.
When we talk about biologics, for an example, we know that these are biological drugs, and we always think of them as, you know, something that is only can be available to people who can afford it mm-hmm. because it is so expensive.
No, the paradigm has shifted.
It has. And there's a difference between what a biosimilar drug and what a biologic drug is. Mm-hmm. So in the studio with us, newly crowned and newly minted Datin Paduka Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang. She's the CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia. I mean, it was so easy in the past to just say Professor Dr. Teo, but now we have to add on this wonderful title that you got. Congratulations. And this just happened a couple of days ago.
Tuesday, right?
Thank you.
From the Sultan of Selangor himself.
That's correct. Hi, Mira, and hi, George. Yeah. You can still call me Oi, Soo. So it's still the same.
But
it's
we have okay. to curtsy beforehand.
We already did
when right.
she walked in. but congratulations from all of us. I mean, you've worked very hard at the Cancer Research Malaysia to do so much for, you know, cancer care and everything, you know, just championing the whole cancer cause. What did it feel like to receive that award?
I think I have a serious bout of imposter syndrome. So certainly, you know, it's getting an award from the Sultan was a huge privilege, really a huge privilege. And to have it in the same year as getting an award from Queen Elizabeth is quite mm-hmm. unusual.
Yes.
And so it's been a pretty special year all the way around.
But so you got it from the Queen, Sultan of Selangor. Mm-hmm. So probably just next one is Donald Trump.
No, another one. I wouldn't receive it. And I won't let you get it either.
Sorry, I interrupted.
Yes.
But I think overall, it's really nice because ultimately what we've been trying to do is to do more cancer research focus on Asians. And it hasn't been easy doing that in an Asian setting and in a charitable sector. Mm. So to have recognition, I think, is just both royal houses really giving some limelight to a charity that has the audacity to think we can make a difference, and hopefully we'll get more people supporting us. I know BFM and George Lee is very supportive mm-hmm. of the work that we do, and raising awareness of the work that we're trying to achieve, it's really important. So I see it as the honour is really due to a very big team, the team of donors and clinicians and doctors and patients and etc. who really work very hard to help us get started with this mission and achieve something significant. So nice to get the award.
Well done to all of you, really. Datin Paduka.
Mm-hmm.
we were just talking about why you're not Datuk Paduka, but it's interesting how the title differs from, you know, the other titles, mm-hmm. isn't it, and how it's conferred to the person. So coming back to the Health Ministry and the announcement that now it has approved a biosimilar version, can you pronounce that drug to me, please? It's the targeted therapy. What is it? How do you pronounce it?
It's called trastuzumab.
Okay.
So trastuzumab. So every drug has got a name that is its chemical name. And all what we call monoclonal antibodies have the MAB at the end. Mm-hmm. So it always ends with a MAB. So you've got nivolumab and pembrolizumab and trastuzumab and so many other MABs that are around. So essentially it's very different from the old days of generating drugs where they are generated by chemical compounds that mm-hmm. you join together with a chemical reaction. So these are what we call small molecules that fit into biological proteins to get an effect like killing a cancer cells. But biologics are different. So biologics are essentially what we call antibodies. They are a structure which is actually normally made by your own body. Mm-hmm. And what we do in this is you actually get the normal cells that can produce these antibodies, and you fuse them to an immortal cell, and you then have a cell line that can a human cell line that can now produce these biologics. That means you actually need to grow those live cells to grow this protein, and then this protein can then be injected into a human body. So in other words, rather than an antibody that is made by yourself, it's an antibody that you make in a laboratory or in a pharmaceutical process, mm-hmm. that you call a biologic. So this whole class is a completely different class of pharmaceutical agents that's not based on chemicals, mm. right? The way you do chemicals is you join chemicals, and yeah. We all remember our titration experiments and pouring mm-hmm. one chemical into another. Mm-hmm. That's a chemical reaction, whereas biologics are actually completely different in terms of how they are made sustainably and what is their mechanism of action. So their mechanism of action is essentially it's an antibody that binds to a particular... Antibodies bind to things very specifically.
Could you give me an example? For an example, you're going to take one of my cells, yeah. and then what are you going to do with it?
So let me go back to what antibodies do in the first place, yeah. right? So if you think about it, you know, if when you're very young, the first time you get to school, you're exposed to a flu virus, mm-hmm. right? So what happens in your flu virus? Well, of course, you have, you know, part of your immune cells comes and attacks the virus, but another part of your immune cells come and recognize what is specific about this virus, and then it stores that memory in mm-hmm. your long-term memory, right? So that long-term memory is made by B cells. And so that the next time you see this virus, what will happen is your B cells will come out and say, I've seen this before, mm-hmm. I know what to do, I'll generate a lot of antibodies. And these antibodies will now bind to the virus, and your immune cells will now activate and kill those viruses much faster than the first time you were exposed to it. So that process is where antibodies, natural formed antibodies, actually work, right? Mm-hmm. In response to these things. But what we can now do is you can take those cells that can make the antibodies, you can fuse them to something that makes those cells immortal, mm-hmm. so that now, that hybridoma cell, which is essentially a spleen plus something else, allows you to keeps churning out mm-hmm. one antibody. And that antibody has a specific response. So every antibody can bind a specific protein in a specific way. So it's the beauty of biologics is its specificity with minimal side effects. Right? In theory, when you have an antibody, it only recognizes one specific thing. Even down to a protein, it recognizes one part of a protein, not the entire protein. You know, one antibody recognizes this part, another antibody to the same protein recognizes a different part of that protein.
So now the antibody is going to recognize the cancer cell?
Yes. So what actually happens is that for some cancers, and this is not for all cancers, mm-hmm. but for some cancers, because if you think about how cancers develop, cancers are essentially cells that are growing out of control. So when these cells are growing out of the control, what actually happens is that our cells has got signals like gates at the surface. You know, we have a fence and we have a gate, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have someone that can put a key in the gate, they can come into the house and etc. So in the same way, for when your cell receives extra, you know, signals from the external, then they start to proliferate when they are needed. Right? Mm. But in cancer cells, they proliferate even when they are not needed. So it's proliferation of cells out of control. And it's controlled by this gate or this receptor in the surface. So what most of these antibodies do, not all, but some of these antibodies, they essentially bind to this receptor. So they bind to the cancer cells that have this receptor. And they either tell the immune system, please kill these cells, because in the same immune response, or they block the ability of that receptor to tell the cell to divide when it's not supposed to divide, mm-hmm. therefore controlling the growth of these cells. So biologics are a type of cancer therapy that really block the signals that enable the cancer cells to grow.
Okay.
This is the technique that is kind of monoclonal antibodies. It's been around for a while, right?
Absolutely. So it was first created in Cambridge. And what they
naturally.
Did, of course.
Sorry, Mira, just have to rub that in.
No. Two Cambridge people in the room, you absolutely need to rub it in.
Well, I didn't go to Oxford either, so it doesn't matter to me, really.
Okay, right, sorry.
Poor me.
So, yes, so it was originally identified in Cambridge, and, you know, and this year, actually, there's been a lot of Nobel Prizes that have been given out for immunotherapy, right? From yes. from the discovery of the first antigen that can be used to stimulate the patient's immune system so that now the immune system can be activated to fight cancer. And I would say that this is one of the really big years for immunotherapy to have the Nobel
This technique has been around for 20 years, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What has changed in that last 20 years? Why is it so exciting again?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. The technique was only allows you to scale up the production of these antibodies. But in the first place, you need to know what are you going to block, mm-hmm. right? If you don't know what is the gate, what is the key that you need to produce, then obviously you can't control the cell anyway. So the one part is generating the antibody, but the second part is understanding what do you need to target to be able to control the growth of the cell. So I think what has been major this year is that previously, we've been working at changes that are only specific to certain cancer cells, whereas now the approach is very much to train the immune system to recognize similar things so that they can attack all cancer cells. And the durability of the response has just shot through the roof. And I think that's where we are hugely excited in cancer research.
So is a biologic considered immunotherapy?
No, not all immunotherapies are biologic and not all biologics are immunotherapy. So you must think about it as biologics just refer to the production of proteins or antibodies that can recognize a specific antigen and it's as opposed to a chemical. So just think about it as you either have chemicals or you have biologics. And you can have chemicals that can prevent psoriasis or treat psoriasis. You can have biologics that can treat psoriasis. In the same way, you can have chemicals like chemotherapy that can treat cancer. You can also have biologics that can treat cancer. And in treating diseases, you can't just use one thing. Very often, you need to find what is the most efficacious or the most effective one. And sometimes you even have to use them in combination to get that combined effect.
Okay, interesting. And so what is a biosimilar then? Because now the Ministry of Health has approved a biosimilar version of the drug you call...
Trastuzumab.
Thank you. Thank you. Trastuzumab.
Trust. Only just put a T. You know, make it trendy.
Trastuzumab. So,
the big
you know,
T or something, right?
So is a biosimilar a biologic?
Yes. So essentially, I'm sure you know the word generic.
Yes.
So everyone knows the term generic. And generic compounds are essentially, in the past, the pharmaceutical company would make a compound and show that, okay, I can use this compound to treat a disease. And after my patent period has lapsed, so you have 20 years patent protection, for example, when you know nobody else can produce mm-hmm. that compound, then after that patent protection is up, then everyone can produce
is
that, that
exact
compound.
Is it an identical copy of the original generic?
No. Yes. So generics are generally an identical copy because it is a chemical compound. So a compound that you generate will be identical,
yep.
right? But George has put his finger right on the pulse and he knows exactly what he's talking about because a biosimilar is not exactly the same as the original compound. Because antibodies are naturally occurring compounds, right? Mm-hmm. So that means that when you fuse a cell to make it immortal, it chucks out one antibody. But if another company is going to produce it, they don't have that exact cell line. Mm-hmm. So what they will be using is something else, but targeting the same protein. So you're actually using a biosimilar because the exact antibody is actually not it's not exactly the same, but it may do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the process of approval for regulators like the FDA is different because if you think about how drugs are approved, what we first do is in a phase one clinical trial, you determine, is it safe for human beings to take? You know, if I inject it, is that human being going to have a heart attack or have some adverse events? And that's what you're trying to do. In the second stage, you're trying to see, do I have a signal for efficacy? You know, does it actually treat the disease that I hope it will treat? You know, and then at the third stage, what you do is you compare what happens with giving one treatment versus a standard of care to see whether it improves outcome. Because obviously, if it doesn't improve outcome, who will want to buy the drug, right? So you want to make sure that it improves the outcome. But when you're doing a biosimilar, you don't actually need to do, or when you're evaluating a generic, you don't need to do all three,
mm-hmm.
right? Because what you're essentially trying to do, for a generic, you don't need to do the safety again, but you do what is called a bioequivalent study. A bioequivalent study is where you're just showing that if I give a patient the generic, does it give the same effect as the original patented compound?
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, there's no difference. So it cannot be more effective. Not only can it not be less effective, it also cannot be more effective. If it's more effective, it will actually fail the regulatory process.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be within a statistical margin, not more effective, not less effective than the approved one, then you can approve it for this particular indication.
It's a bit like knockoff iPhone, lah, which is legal.
This is a generic.
That's yes, right.
This is a generic.
But it's not quite an iPhone, but it's like a knockoff.
Yes.
And so
it's actually not a bad analogy, you know, because, you know, if you think about it, you have an iPhone that does things, but Androids also do the same thing. So maybe you can consider that, you know, biologics and biosimilars are like an iPhone and a phone that's from a different brand that has very similar features. You know, you have the...
It's not exactly the same.
Yeah, but the FDA scrutiny will be like same, but different lah.
Yes, correct.
Yes,
boleh pakai, can wear, can use. So when we talk about the HER2 positive breast cancer, which is what this targeted therapy is actually for, could you just very quickly explain to us what that is?
So it's a receptor that's present in the cells, in the surface of the cells in about 25% of breast cancers, right? And when present, it drives the proliferation or the growth of the cancers. So if you can use HER2-targeted therapy, and there are two sorts, one is a small chemical base, one is the biologic, then you can block the development of cancers and control those. And actually, because of biologics and HER2-targeted therapy, HER2-positive disease, which used to be one of the worst outcome, has now been transformed for the women who can access the treatment, one of the best outcomes for breast cancer. If you think about absolute improvement in survival for breast cancer, this has actually really been transformative in terms of giving more patients an added benefit.
But trastuzumab is what you're referring to.
That's
okay.
Correct.
All right. So it used to be very costly in the past, and we're hoping that the biosimilar will be less costly. Whether or not it will be, we're not terribly sure. We'll find out more about that. And also, we're going to be speaking to Professor Datu Dr. Tunku Sara Ahmad. She's a consultant orthopedic surgeon from UMMC who is a breast cancer, fourth stage breast cancer survivor who went on trastuzumab and sort of benefited from that. She will share her experience with it right after this on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me. Today we're discussing biosimilars and biologics. The Health Ministry has approved a biosimilar version of a targeted therapy for women with HER2-positive breast cancer. Now, if you're wondering, patients have a gene mutation which promotes the growth of cancer cells by making a lot of the HER2 receptor, and then the drug is now going to be made available for many women who have this HER2 positive breast cancer. And on the line with us is a breast cancer survivor who actually went on trastuzumab, which is the biosimilar which is going to be made available to many Malaysians for a much lower cost. And she is Professor Datu Dr. Tunku Sara Ahmad. She's a consultant orthopedic surgeon at the University of Malaya Medical Center. How are you today, Professor?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks to trastuzumab in part.
Yes. We just want to share, could you share with us, you know, tell us about how you were diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer?
Okay. Hi, Sue, Datin Paduka, George and Mira. I'm on first term, first name basis with you because I've listened so often to your programs. Okay.
And
so
big supporter of Cancer Research Malaysia.
Yes.
Of course. It's a very good organization to support. Yes, I was diagnosed. I came back from sabbatical from Paris, and I noticed that one sleeve of my jacket was tighter than the other. And in the end, it led me to discover that I had swelling or lymphedema in one of my arms, which was very tricky to diagnose, despite being in the same hospital as many very good specialists. In the end, after lots of delay and all kinds of investigations, I found out that I had a very rare kind of breast cancer, which is inflammatory breast cancer, which is 4% of the total. And this manifested in swelling of the left arm. And it started to begin as a rash on my arm and then later my breast. So that's how I got diagnosed.
Okay. And what was the prognosis at that time?
Prognosis? Well, I think prognosis depends on how you face the... how you manage it, I guess. But stage four, you know, some used to be very poor prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
But it was HER2 positive. And sometimes they say, you know, despite the fact that it's growing really fast and et cetera, but that means that it will respond better to something which attacks things with a high metabolic rate. So I went on to this HER2 therapy plus other things, which I think the lay public calls what? Poison... burn and poison burn and flash or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on immediately before doing surgery and radiation. I went on Herceptin or sort of trastuzumab, as you call it.
Yep.
And I could immediately feel the battle going on in this left breast of mine. It was like a war.
Mm.
Not necessarily painful, but you know. Many people have the surgery first. They don't realize what's going on. But I could really feel it fighting. And it reduced down to almost nothing in the end. And later I had my mastectomy and then went on to radiation to prevent further recurrence. And I've been on some form of trastuzumab since then, which is a long time.
Right. How long has it been?
Well, from the initial diagnosis, it's actually more than 10 years. But since the last recurrence, it's 5 years tumor-free.
That's fantastic. So what are your...
Grateful.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, Prof. Tjoja, very, very quickly, do many women benefit from this, Prof. Sarah?
I think, unfortunately, because trastuzumab was such an expensive treatment, or at least the patented form of trastuzumab was such an expensive treatment, it wasn't available to everybody. So that basically meant that if for women who could afford to pay, you know, particularly in a private practice, for example, I think close to 80% of women, I think, actually have access to trastuzumab because they either have insurance or they have their own out-of-pocket expenses that can continue to pay at those rates. But within the government service, it has been very difficult because, as you know, our budget for healthcare in the past has traditionally been fairly low. So for senior government servants and so on, it may have been possible, or for a limited budget, it was a bit of a postcode lottery. Sometimes you got it, sometimes you didn't.
Okay.
Prof. Sarah, I remember I was still working at UM at the time you were diagnosed, and you know, Ching Ha was extremely supportive. I mean, it's rude for me to ask, but how expensive was the treatment for you at that time, Eva, for somebody who was paying for this?
Okay, I have to say thank you very much to University of Malaya because they supported my treatment.
Fantastic. And your thoughts on the biosimilar version of the therapy being made available now, or soon at least in Malaysia?
Well, I have sat in daycare, oncology daycare, countless number of times with other women, and many of them say, you know, we've decided not to do it. Because it's like 4,008 three weekly for 17 doses, and who can afford that?
Yep.
And basically, there are complications. You know, like you have to go for an echo every 3 months because there's some myocardial complications, and maybe some hand and foot, a little bit of cracks in the skin, etc. But basically, it's a treatment that you can live with and carry on working.
Okay.
So I go from my therapy back to work, you know, back to a meeting. So I tell her, can you speed up this infusion? I need to get to the office in, you know, 20 minutes. It just sounds bizarre, but really, that's the way you can.
So typical doctor, isn't it?
Go on working.
Yes, but why is it so expensive? Do we know?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Sue can say that, but probably because the initial drug company spent so much on researching, mm-hmm. And they need to make their money back. That's number one. And I think before you can get a biosimilar or generic version, you need to run out, the patent needs to run out on the initial drug. So, they have to have made their money by that finite amount of time.
Right.
So I guess that's why it's so expensive.
Yeah. Prof, can you kindly elaborate a little bit about, you said you had several versions of this targeted therapy throughout the last 10 years or so. You know, so how effective is this drug generally, and also why were you on various form of such treatment?
Oh, well, the first time, of course, it was my treatment, and following that, it was prevention, more or less. And it was combined with other things. The first time was combined with other chemotherapies, because you have to do two or three together to actually knock it on the head. But with the maintenance, I'm now on an oral chemo, which I take every morning, the first thing I wake up, and then this trastuzumab every 3 weeks.
So, and you're still going from strength to strength.
I'm still, yes, I'm so happy I managed to celebrate my 60th birthday. I'm so grateful.
Fantastic, fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing, you know, your story with us. That was Professor Dato Dr. Tunku Sara Ahmad, consultant orthopedic surgeon at University of Malaya Medical Center, sharing her journey with trastuzumab, which is going to be hopefully made available. I mean, Prof Teo, I mean, does it mean that a biosimilar is going to be much cheaper than a biologic?
Unfortunately, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is something that that the public need to know, that when it comes to chemicals, when the cost of synthesis of a chemical is actually relatively cheap compared to the price at which it's marketed. So in some cases, the cost of making a drug could be less than $1, and the price that you sell it could be several thousands of dollars. But the price of producing a biologic is actually, the process itself is actually quite expensive. And the quality standards that are required to produce that biologic is actually quite different. And also, all of the supply chain, etc., is actually quite different as well. So that means that, you know, there is going to be hopefully a reduction in price, but it won't be as big as what we would see in chemical generics. Generics compared to the chemical compounds is not going to be such a big difference compared to biosimilars compared to the biologic compounds that we actually see.
Does every patient with the HER2 positive breast cancer, will they benefit from targeted therapy? They will.
That's right, yeah. So we know that at least, and this doesn't apply to all diseases, but certainly for HER2 positive disease, you know, particularly in the breast, HER2 is also present in other diseases. So it's important to know that HER2 as a marker is also present in gastric cancer, for example. It's also present in some, in very rare forms, but in some of the other types of cancers. And there's some suggestions that HER2 targeted therapy will benefit not just HER2 positive breast cancers, but also HER2 positive gastric cancers and so on and so forth. So it's important that in this new era of targeted therapy, we start to treat cancers not by just their geographical location, but i.e. their organ, but also by the molecular profiles, so the genetic profiles that are present in the tumour itself.
Okay.
I think coming back to the cost of treatment, why is treatment so expensive, right? And I think sometimes we forget to pause and think about this social contract that we have with the pharmaceutical companies. The reality is that drugs will be available at the price that our governments will be available to pay for them, mm-hmm. if governments were developing drugs.
Right.
But the reality is that governments cannot take the risk of drug development, right? Because you invest so much in drug development, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually an unspoken social contract that we have with the pharmaceutical companies, where we transfer all of the risk of developing a drug to the pharmaceutical company. You say, you take all the risk,
yeah.
you put in the $1 billion that is required for the development of each drug. But the payback is that if your drug succeeds, you potentially stand to gain $2 to $4 billion a year in just the sales of that drug.
Yeah, I mean, every time...
Otherwise, you'd be using taxpayer money to develop drugs now, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah,
because every time you speak to a pharmaceutical stakeholders, they always highlight that, look, every 100 drugs we trialed, and it's only one of them probably might turn out to be successful. So, of course, that's the argument that is going to justify the cost. However, what I see, biosimilarity has a lot of differences because, you know, like you said, or the risk has been taken by someone else already. So I'm very surprised to hear that you say it's not necessarily cheaper. So in the capacity as Cancer Research Malaysia, can we look at that biosimilarity and actually develop whatever you need to develop and actually, you know, benefit from that at much lower price? Is that a potential that Cancer Research Malaysia may embark on?
I think
where will
from
they get their money from, George?
No, I mean, because all that
risk has been taken. It's been de-risked, right. Isn't it?
So that's you right. Just copy lah.
Yeah,
quite.
You just knock off iPhone like and then sell it off, right?
I'm a photostat machine.
That's right.
Oi, Sue, photostat.
Yeah.
Photostat. Chifat.
Yeah, don't buy the original book, just photostat.
No, but this is not exactly like that. It's not a whole, you just can't photostat.
Same, but different.
Yeah.
I think that we must accept that biosimilars development and the final price may not be different because the cost of production may actually not allow you to bring down the cost too much overall, right? But we must take a look at the bigger picture, the wider picture of what governments can do, right? What governments should do in order to reduce our total healthcare budget and improve access to drugs to a lot more individuals. What can governments do? The reality is that, you know, I was asking the producer this afternoon, how much, if you think of the world's richest country, the USA, right? How much of their drug budget goes towards buying generics as opposed to branded products? Hazard a guess, Mira. What do you think that number is? How much of the US budget, apparently,
In percentage,
goes towards generics as opposed to branded products?
70%.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So somewhere between 70 to 80% or even higher may go into generics. So
what
the
about
reality,
us?
I don't think we know the numbers for us, right? So the reality is that if as a community we want to tackle access and funding to drugs and so on, we need to make sure that our regulators, our local regulators are on the ball to approve generics or biosimilars quite quickly while protecting and ensuring that they're efficacious and not detrimental to the public. That's number one, right? So we need to make sure that our regulators are on the ball so that as soon as the patent has run out, 6 months later, you have regulatory approval already because all of the data packages, etc., are already there so that it can be approved and it can be used as quickly as possible, right? That would improve efficiency of the service. The second thing that you can do is actually really look at how do you make sure that you negotiate hard on price, that you work out how do you negotiate hard on price. Do you negotiate just for the government service, or do you negotiate for the country? How do you do these price negotiations? Not an easy question, but issues that I think are very important if we're going to be able to change the outcome in terms of making sure that there's more affordable therapies at a shorter time span for as many patients as we can afford.
I mean, this is something that we were a bit surprised last week when we interviewed somebody who was fighting for a very expensive drugs for rare disease. And then the father was saying there is no benchmark for the price. It's all negotiable between government and pharma. Is that true? I mean, even for Herceptin, are we talking about such variability between Kathmandu and Singapore?
Well, the reality is that there are only three regions in the world that pay for 95% of the profits of the pharmaceutical companies, apparently. They are the US or North America. So US and Canada combined, Europe and Japan.
Oh.
That's it. So the majority of the profits of the pharmaceutical company comes from these markets. And everyone else, despite us having large populations, etc., actually contribute very little to the profits of these big pharmas for the common diseases, right? So we have to think, how do we negotiate? The reality is that Malaysia is actually very lucky. we pay less for branded products, particularly in cancer, compared to other countries. So the price, I think, is similar. But what they do locally is you might be buy two, get one, buy 10 months, get the rest free, etc. This kind of, you know, packaging deals enables Malaysian patients to actually access the branded products probably cheaper than elsewhere. Certainly, it's cheaper than Singapore. So we have some advantages here already. But we, even so, we still cannot afford the branded products. Yeah. Because the reality is, who can afford 5,000? You know, Prof. Sarah was saying 5,000, that was 10 years ago. Yeah. Today's price is 8,000 to 10,000 per every 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Who can afford that kind of prices? The reality is, only if you have insurance, and even then, only if you have high level of insurance, and not even insurance, the standard insurance.
They don't cover lifelong.
That's correct. Yeah.
But it's interesting how you say if we improve our logistical and approval process, as soon as we know that branded products are, you know, patents are going to expire, then we'll be ready for generics to come in, and that would save us a whole lot of money.
Funny that efficiency is observed for the blue pills. As soon as the patent was over, there were about 15 generic companies all lined up ready to actually roll out the blue pills.
Yeah, they were, companies are probably ready with it, but then government needs to be ready to approve and get them into the market is what Prof. Teo is actually saying.
Yes, which is why this move by the Ministry of Health, I think, is really great. So I really would like to commend the Malaysia Baru and the new government and the new Minister of Health for this move. You know, to move quickly to approve the biosimilar for trastuzumab means that hopefully this therapy will become available in Malaysia. I think there's still question marks about the data package and whether it's safe, etc. But I'm very confident that it is. And this also means what's the final price that will be sold to patients, how do they get access, and so on. And my wish is that more and more women have access to this targeted therapy that does save their lives.
Has the patent expired already?
Yes. But of course, the pharma companies have got new formulations. So they have new formulations that are delivered in a different way. They've also combined this monoclonal antibody with a chemotherapy that means that you have a homing device. You use the antibody to find the cancer cells, and then it delivers a package of a toxic compounds that kills the cancer cells. So this is called Kadcyla. And Kadcyla is, of course, a drug that even
nice
improves
name.
The
cancer. I know. I was just thinking.
Sounds like Godzilla, doesn't it?
Right.
Yeah. You can never
like
forget that.
Cartoon, yeah. Kadcyla. Yeah. Yeah. You come up with a new version.
So there are always newer versions with improved outcomes, combinations that you can do. And that's how pharmaceutical companies, as an industry, continue to drive the economy, right?
Yep. So trastuzumab can be used in early stage and in metastatic. Thank you very much. In those sorts of breast cancer as well.
Yes. So this is really difficult. You know, it's a very difficult issue. Resource allocation when the pie is very small, the cake is very small, and the need is very high is a very, very difficult issue. And I don't think I have an answer to that. But, you know, if in a country like in the UK, for example, you know, 98% of the healthcare expenditure in the UK, maybe, is on the National Health Service. Don't quote me on the number, but very high, right? And in that setting, the National Health Service, through the National Institutes of Clinical Excellence and the regulatory agencies and so on, can say to the pharma company, okay, we'll buy the drug if you can show this efficacy at this price. You need to improve quality of life by this amount for this price, then we'll pay for all of the people who will benefit from it, and it'll be available throughout the country, right? So they can negotiate hard on price on the basis of that. That doesn't happen in Malaysia, and actually doesn't happen in the majority of middle-income countries because they don't have the resources that are necessary to do that. The only country that does it well in the region is actually Thailand. And I know that our National Cancer Institute, or ICAN, have been establishing collaborations with Thailand and the Health Technology Assessment Unit there to really learn expertise so that we can really evaluate how do you go from evidence-based medicine to value-based medicine. What's the difference? Evidence-based medicine, if treatment A works better than...
I love how Prof, you know, will just ask her own question and just go on.
I'm so sorry,
she's got it already.
My mouth was on the floor.
I should just shut up now. I'm in lecture mode. Yeah. Sorry.
I figured so.
it's Christmas. We deserve, we indulge in such fluent and efficient delivery.
Go ahead,
sorry
please.
About that,
go ahead, please.
I've lost my my train of thought.
I think it's so.
You were talking about the differences between the evidence-based and also value-based.
Value, yeah, yes. That's right. That was really quite interesting, actually.
So evidence-based medicine is if treatment A works better than treatment B, it goes into the guidelines. That's essentially what happens in the U.S. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., if you look at the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, what goes into there is every treatment that is better than the one that was available goes into there, regardless of the price. So if it's $1 million, it still goes in there. But value-based medicine talks about, is it affordable? What sort of quality of life? And quality of life is measured according to the average income for that particular country. So that basically means that something that meets your quality of life, quality adjusted life years measurements in terms of improvement in how long more you survive, may be different in the UK compared to what it is in Malaysia. So you're now talking about value-based medicine. Are you going to sell your house to for 3 months additional survival? Mm-hmm. Whereas if in the UK, you might not be selling your house. You might be, you know, investing 10% of your savings to give you that 3 months of survival. Mm-hmm. Right? It's about value.
It makes sense, right? I mean, is that what NICE is doing now, value-based medicine? Because
yes.
Because the efficacy of the drug is not adjustable, but the price is variable.
Yeah, absolutely right. So this is exactly what all the European countries do. It's always based on value-based medicine. So they ask you, okay, if you can sell it at this price, according to my how much I have to pay for every year that I live extra or for every year of additional survival with certain quality measures in place, then yes, the National Health Service will pay for that. So it's a challenge for Malaysia. So because what should Malaysia do? Because currently, we are half of our healthcare expenditure is public purse, and the other half is out-of-pocket expenses, which is actually the worst possible system. It's the most inefficient system to deliver healthcare services for our population.
Okay. Do you think in terms of survival, Prof. Sarah is one of the unique people who has benefited so much from trastuzumab?
I think, you know, the reality is that trastuzumab treatment has benefited a lot of women overall. You know, for many other treatments, targeted therapies, sometimes they only extend survival by a few months. But HER2 targeted therapy has improved survival for a significant proportion of women who have breast cancer. And, you know, I think the message for the public is Sarah's 10-year survival with stage 4 breast cancer.
You know, it's a typical statistic.
Not necessarily typical, but, you know, the reality is if you reflect and ask, you know, if your best friend told you today that she has cancer and she has stage 4 cancer, what would you be thinking? You're preparing for months, right? You're not thinking 10 years. So the fact is that, you know, when the treatment is right, it doesn't matter whether it's Herceptin, targeted therapy, immunotherapy, etc. When the treatment is right, the fight against cancer actually becomes incredibly successful.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think biosimilars will impact the healthcare cost? Do you think it's going to make a difference at all?
I hope so. Like I said, I don't think we know yet what is the price, the end price that goes to the patient. Because you must remember that, you know, the end price to a patient is not necessarily what the price at which the pharma company sells the drug. Mm-hmm. Because when the pharma company sells the drug, then someone in between marks it up and then there's other costs involved. Mm-hmm. So the final price to the patient is actually quite different. So I think those things we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. We've passed the first hurdle, which is the regulatory approval.
I mean, Suhan, I'm going to ask you, I put you on the spot as a CEO for Cancer Research Malaysia. I mean, obviously, you guys are in the forefront for especially breast cancer and then in diagnostic, prevention, supportive, and then, you know, all the research works all in the forefront, especially for Asian and Malaysian patients. So when I knew that you were coming for this interview along this, you know, we were talking about how to make cancer treatment affordable for Malaysians. What do you think will be the role of Cancer Research Malaysia advocating to push the envelopes a little bit in research and also policy alterations for the Malaysian population?
I think I'll answer the first question in terms of research. So, you know, previously I would have been on the show talking about germline predisposition, Angelina Jolie and so on, and all about how do we know in individuals' risk of cancer and so on. What I haven't come onto the show to talk about is really now our new project, which is really looking at the genetics of the tumour itself. So what goes wrong at the genetic level in the tumour, and how do we use the information to predict response for treatment and new treatments for breast cancer patients. So this is now the largest study in Asia. So we now already have characterized about 600 tumours compared to 1,000 in the US and 2,000 in the UK. And by far, it's the largest study in Asian. And what we've been able to show is that Asians have a propensity to develop immune-rich tumours, which suggests that they may actually benefit from a different type of immunotherapy for breast cancer. So we're really delighted that we've just, are probably going to be able to launch our first immunotherapy in breast cancer trial. And we're going to be able to test what this means in terms of new treatment options. We also find that Asian patients are more likely to have HER2-positive disease, and that might also mean that this new development will be particularly important for our setting of Asian breast cancer patients. So on the research front, I'm a very big proponent that what we should be doing is doing research to help us understand which patients will benefit from which treatment and making sure that we accelerate that whole process so that patients get the treatment much faster. But on the other side is an advocacy solution, right? And working with the Galen Center and a number of other key experts, we're now starting to get together to say, what are our priorities? So together with the Galen Center, we've put out a position paper on what are the short term, what should we be doing in terms of cancer control? What are the four best buys today? What are the eight longer term best buys? And I think we need to increase that advocacy voice.
Yes.
And I'm really delighted that under the new government, we seem to have more dialogues. You know, there are conversations with both the minister, the deputy minister and so on. And I hope that will continue so that it becomes a much more joined up process, that NGOs together with the learned individuals at the universities and the ministry and civil society can work together for appropriate cancer control.
Fantastic. Your message on biosimilars?
Well, I think it's thumbs up absolutely to the Ministry of Health for starting this journey of approving biosimilars. Please continue, because there's a huge need to bring in therapies and take it one step further. Improve the regulatory process, continue to improve the regulatory processes and drive down costs and negotiate better for price, because so many more women are going to benefit from this and so many more cancer patients and their families are going to benefit from this.
George?
Well, congratulations on everything. I'm glad Cancer Research Malaysia is taking a different dimension now in the fight for cancers. The BFM new acronym, BFM, will be Best Fighting Malignancy, right?
Very good.
Yeah, that's
well, good
right.
job, George.
For Cancer Research Malaysia.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, we're all big supporter. And then obviously for people who want to help, want to contribute, and then what do they do for, to contact Cancer Research Malaysia?
Well, we have a website and so on. But what we really like to do is get a community of supporters who can donate a little monthly and help us sustain this activity. Because cancer research is fully dependent on charitable funding as well as on research grants. We've been successful in winning international grants. But these international grants expect you to have a core facility that is world-class. And we don't have that. We have very, very basic. So to be able to continue the work, sign up as a regular donor. You can do that on our website or come and get a form, the simple, basic form.
Thank you both very much for joining me today. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Datin Paduka Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang, from CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia, speaking to us about making cancer treatment affordable when the Ministry of Health approved biosimilar drugs, which probably will be available sometime next year. On The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.